This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm more nervous than I thought I would be. As most of you probably know, the first lecture that the Shiso gives is called the Way-Seeking Mind Lecture, kind of how I came to practice. And in my case, I kind of think of it as a long road and kind of a spiritual journey. And I'm going to begin by singing a little song to you. And it's a song my father sang to me when I was about 4 or 5 years old, something like that. Excuse my voice. After the ball was over, Sally took out her glass eye, stuck her false teeth in a saucer, drank a bottle of rye. I think I've forgotten it already. Let me start again. After the ball was over, Sally took out her glass eye. I always get these parts mixed up. Put her peg leg in the corner and drank a bottle of rye. Stuck her false teeth in a saucer. Hung her wig on the wall. What happened to our poor Sally after the ball? And I very distinctly remember every time my father would sing that song to me, I would break out laughing because in my childish mind, I thought, well, if you take away this and you take away that and then another thing, well, what happened to Sally? Where did she go? All these parts are hung on the wall and whatnot. And, you know, over the years, of course, I've reflected on that quite a few times and thought, gee, that sort of sounds like something maybe like the Heart Sutra or something. And I'm not saying, of course, you know, that my father was some great bodhisattva and he planted this seed in my childish brain. But it has given me pause to think over the years. Anyways, so much for that. Kind of had a normal childhood, only child, blah, blah, blah. And everything was kind of going along relatively smoothly until I hit puberty. And then it's like, oh, boys and girls are different. Boys are a little more interesting than girls. And in the milieu in which I grew up, which was waspish America circa, you know, mid-50s, I knew even without being told that there was something wasn't right with that, that I did not fit in to everything else that everyone else was doing. And I didn't maybe wonder about it in so many words, but sort of always hovering in the back of my mind was like, who am I and how do I fit into all this stuff? I just couldn't quite figure it out. Somehow, though, I did manage to sort of stumble through high school and not too long after I graduated, I heard the siren call of San Francisco. Come to San Francisco with flowers in your hair. I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good. Because basically, I did not want to grow up. I did not want to go out into that world that felt alien to me and try and make my place in it. And from what I heard of San Francisco, it sounded, it just sounded cool and different. And I didn't know what I was going to find here. I didn't know if I was going to fit in. I didn't know anything. I just thought, I'm going to do that. And so I piled into a 56 Chevy with 10 other people, and we came to San Francisco, and of course I immediately started taking drugs, because that's what everyone else was doing, and had a high old time. It was lots of fun, and also in the air at the time, sort of in tangent with the in tandem with the drug taking was this sort of spiritual thing going on. There were lots of Hindu scriptures being looked at, and various, you know, Krishna and whatnot. It was just sort of all in the air, and at that time I read a lot of Alan Watts, D.T. Suzuki, and Carl Jung. And once again, kind of trying to figure out what's all this mean? Does it apply to me? Is it helpful in some way? I can't say that I really did anything with that information. It was just something I sort of partially absorbed at the time. And I went on through the disco era, more drug taking, different drugs, but life was good, I guess you'd say. I mean, I was having a good time. I was young, and I was getting laid on a regular basis and whatnot. So at one point, I had this boyfriend, or a friend with benefits, or some hybrid of the two, and I really wanted it to be more than just a boyfriend or somebody to hang out with. I wanted the cottage with the white picket fence, and we'll raise poodles together, or some such thing like that. I had some dim fantasy in my mind of meeting someone and falling in love, and I would love them and they would love me, and everything would be good after that. This guy was going to have none of that. And I'd been looking for that for a while, but somehow this time around, when I basically didn't get what I wanted out of life, no surprise there, I thought to myself, if I can't love just one person, maybe I should love everyone. It sounds kind of funny to say that now, but that's really how I felt at the time. And I wondered how I might go about loving everyone. So it just so happened that my housemate at the time had the book Be Here Now by Ram Dass. And it talks in there about several different meditation traditions. And I thought, well, maybe meditation is the way to go. So that was kind of percolating in the back of my mind. And one day, I was riding on the bus. I used to live on Fell Street near Ashbury. I was going downtown, and the bus turned the corner on Page and Laguna, and I looked out the window, and there's a sign in the corner in the building, Zen Center. bing. Wow, what's that? I know I've heard of that because I read Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki and so on, and I got off the bus right there and went over and knocked on the door and said, so what's going on in here? And they said, come back Saturday for orientation. And so I did, and I just jumped right in with both feet. I started sitting on a regular basis. I would ride my bicycle from Fallon, Ashbury, down in the morning for Zazen. I can't remember if I went down for evening Zazen because I might have done it sometimes because I was working part-time at the time. And it was very interesting. I didn't quite know what to make of it because Zen Center was and still is a strange place to me. But it felt right at the time to do that. And I was very fortunate one day to be walking down the little hall from the lobby to use the bathroom. And coming in the opposite direction was Isan. He used to live in what's now the bookstore. There was a small room and bathroom there, and he had like his own like private quarters. And he, you know, sort of beamed at me, hi. And so I kind of went, ooh, you know, I'm not used to people being so sort of straightforwardly friendly like that, especially since I was already getting a little bit of a vibe from Zen Center that, you know, some of these people don't seem too happy or kind of uptight or, you know, something. And so to meet a person that was obviously joyous was really something. And so over time, I got to know Isan a little bit. And we would hang out once in a while with some other folks that were around at the time. Some still with us, some not. And I don't remember exactly how it happened, but he and I and Gary Weiss, who runs the Ixia Flower Shop and still donates flowers to the temple, and some other people who are dead and you wouldn't know their names anyways, got together and said, let's form a gay Buddhist club. Because although there were gay folks around Zen Center at the time, they weren't so sort of out. I mean, Islam was out. Out, as far as you could go. But not so many other people. I wouldn't say that there was, you know, actively homophobia going on there, but it was still, I mean, this was like 1980. So we hadn't pushed our way into mainstream society quite in the way that we have now. So anyway, let's start a gay Buddhist club. And one of the members used to live here. The Zendo was his bedroom. And when we came over here, we used to meet upstairs, and we'd do a little meditation, and then we'd sit and talk, and as I used to say, we'd sit in a circle and smoke cigarettes and talk about how difficult it was to be gay. And that certainly is part of what we did, but finally the fellow that lived down here said, you know what, I'll move upstairs because the room's available, and we can use this as a meditation hall. And as you probably know, this used to be the Dharma Datu here in San Francisco. I think it was the first one. And these columns were like bright red. I think it took about 5 coats of paint to cover that red. So this group was kind of ecumenical Buddhists. There were Buddhists of all stripes, and people that thought they were Buddhists and people that wanted to be Buddhists. So on. But little by little, the Zennies seemed to have more energy or interest or something in what was going on, and so we basically took over. It wasn't exactly a coup, but, you know, we kind of took over. And I won't go into the long history of all of that. Isan was in other parts of the world, in New Mexico and over on Mariposa Street with Bikkur Roshi. And he would come and sort of be our spiritual guide. And we would just somehow manage to limp along in his absence and keep the door open for people to come in for meditation. Because at that point we had, it was probably 1981, we had a regular meditation schedule following the Zen Center model of two periods in the morning at 5:30, I think, one in the evening. After a while, we all loved Isan, and we were kind of feeling like this is really difficult to sort of get along with, like he only coming once in a while. So we asked him if he would come here to be the teacher, and he said, "Okay, I'm going to need a room. I'm going to need this much money," and he laid it all out. This is how it's going to be if I'm going to come, and this is what we're going to do. He was quite firm about how we were going to do things here, pretty much along the traditional line. So we started doing it, and we went on for until, I don't remember when AIDS started kind of creeping up on us. One of the students here, J.D. Kubzak, came down with AIDS, and his partner Pierre was not able to care for him, so his son took him in here, and he was the first hospice resident here. And that grew and grew, and there was some friction going on between, the Zennies wanted it to be just a temple, and then there was a little bit of strife there, but basically Isan got his way. He said, "This is what we're going to do, like it or lump it." So we went on and we did that. We opened the hospice, we took care of people. And at this point, just as the hospice was getting going, or right before perhaps it was, I went to Tassajara. And I was down there for three practice periods and a summer. And I told Isan, I said, when you do get the hospice up and going, I want to come back and be the cook. So he said, okay, and that is in fact what happened. And it was kind of difficult to be around a bunch of dying people. One reason I felt that I could be cook was because there was a little bit of distance between me and death. I could sort of do my share, support the endeavor, but not get too close. So we went on like that, and then Isan became ill. He got AIDS. And I don't remember the year exactly, but at any rate, he ended up ordaining myself and Angelic Farrow and Paul Higley. And Angelic Farrow now lives with Steve Allen down in Colorado, and Paul Higley is dead. And then he died. I got ordained in February, and he died in September. And it was kind of chaotic around here. We were all grieving the loss of our teacher. We were trying to run a hospice. We were trying to sit Zazen every day. And it was a hard row to hoe. And after about a year, I decided I needed to put some space between myself and this place. And So I thought, well, okay, I'm working here, I'm practicing here, and I'm living here. Something's got to give. And so I decided I would move out, and I would still continue to practice here, and I would still continue to work here. And that's what I did. I moved over into the mission, not just a short walk away. So I continued to come here and sit, and I think I was started to take care of Philip at that point, because his eyesight had essentially just gone from glaucoma. And that was another way I could come here and help out. But I found over time, without the day-to-day encouragement of a teacher and the stress of the overall sort of scene that was happening, I started to just back away further and further, little by little, sitting less and less. And finally, I didn't come here at all anymore. And I would try and sit once in a while on my own, and I just could not do it. I couldn't sit still for 5 minutes. I don't know why. I mean, you'd think someone who'd, you know, done sesshins or tasahara and all this stuff would, how could you ever, you know, it's like riding a bicycle or something. You don't forget it. But somehow I couldn't quite get back into it. And I went on at that point to go to City College, horticulture department, got some jobs, started developing a career in that field, and moved way over on the other side of town near City College. And I basically never came here. For some reason, I came one day. It might have been because I was still on a kind of friendly terms with Jennifer. And I came over, and we were sitting out in the back garden, and I looked around, and the roses were a mess. God, those roses need pruning, and here it is, like January or something, and it's really the time to do it. And so I told her, I said, I will come and prune the roses. And this doesn't really sound like something that would necessarily lead you to practice, but it did somehow. Maybe it was just the exposure to the place and that sort of vibe, that good old Zen vibe, you know. But I started coming around more and more. And thank you, Jennifer, up there in the Mile High City. Started coming around more and more, and I would sit with the HIV group on Thursday and or Friday, and sometimes I would show up in the evening for Zazen, and every once in a while I'd come over in the morning. I remember long about this time, John King was still alive, and there were a couple of times, and you know, just a social situation, where he would turn to me and say, "So when are you going to put your robes back on?" I was like, "Ooh, I don't know." You know, I kind of sort of brushed it off, but anyway, I think that there was a little something being planted there. And I continued to come and sit. I forgot a very important part. While I was living out at City College, I found out I had hepatitis C. And I went on a drug regime, and Hep C was wiped out. Great. But there was a really bad depression as an aftermath. And I didn't know at the time that a side effect of the drug was depression. I was taking Wellbutrin, Prozac, whatever, and none of it was working. So I thought, well, maybe therapy would help. I found a Jungian therapist, and I did therapy for a couple of years. And it was helpful because For one thing, I stopped drinking. All the time I was doing on the drug regime and with the aching liver, I was still drinking. So it was certainly good for that. But while I was in therapy, I started having a lot of dreams. Dreams about Isong, and dreams about Hartford Street, and dreams about Tassajara, and dreams about Zen Center, and the dreams were all populated with monks and monkish figures and people I knew or didn't know that were somehow involved in Zen Buddhism. And that was really another turning point for me. That was really what made me decide, maybe I should really investigate again what it means to practice Zen. But this was, you know, along about the time that I started returning here. Anyways, jump forward again, and I considered for a long time moving in here, and I talked with Reverend Yeo once about it, and then somehow it just didn't seem quite right at the time. So I just continued to come whenever. And not so terribly long ago, Bruce can probably remind me, he asked me if I would do a well-being ceremony for his partner who was ill. And he wanted me to wear my robes. And I said, okay. And I did it. And then it wasn't too long after that that his partner Jamie died. And he asked me again if I would come and if I would do a memorial service for Jamie in his apartment and wear my robes once again. I said, yes. It seemed like a request that I couldn't refuse. So I guess, thank you, Bruce. That was another little turning point in my career, as it were. Career as a Zen priest, if there is such a thing. Finally, last year, slightly more than a year now, I asked Mio again, so what would it be like for me to move in? And he says, well, why don't you try and see? So, and somehow, at that point, the time felt right. And so I let my house go and put some things in storage. And came back here, and that was another one of those little turning points. I've rambled more than I intended to ramble, but one point I wanted to make was all along the line, there were these little turning points. The one with the boyfriend, that was the main turning point, because that really shifted my view towards Zen practice. But all these things before and after that, they're also little turning points in my spiritual odyssey. So that brings us to here and now, I guess. And I kind of think of myself as the world oldest Juso. I may not be, but it feels like that. I did want it to say thank you, Hojo-sama, for giving me this opportunity, and thank you all for supporting the Ango and making it happen. I'd like to say just a few words about the Ango. The first one I did was here at Hartford Street, and I don't really remember very much about it, except on the getting up from the first period on the first day of the 5-day session that ended the Ango, my back went out, big time. I just collapsed. to be helped to my room. I stayed in bed while the session was going on, and somehow managed to get back down for the Shuso ceremony. And I asked the Shuso, who was David Schneider, I said, "What is the difference between this body and Buddha's body?" And he said, "Take good care of it." I thought that was a wonderful answer. It really gave me something to think about. And the only other practice periods I've done have been at Tassajara. And if you've been there, you know what that's like. If you haven't, basically once the opening ceremony happens, they lock you in and they throw away the key, or at least hide it for 90 days. And it's just you and these other people and these forms and this schedule. And I think if you're not able to somehow meet and embrace those forms and that schedule, you go a little bit crazy. Sometimes you go a lot crazy. And here, we're not doing it quite like that, of course. At Tassajara, it can feel like those forms are imposed upon you. They're coming from outside, and somebody's laying a trip on you. And if you can give yourself to them, it makes it a little easier. So we're not trying to lay a trip on anybody here. And I don't, to me anyways, it doesn't feel like these forms and the schedules are being imposed on us from somewhere else, outside of ourselves. Here we just have this opportunity to, like Tassajara, to meet the schedule, to meet the forms, embrace them, and become intimate with them as best we can given the circumstances of our lives. It's not about showing up as often all the time. It's not about doing all the ceremonies. It's not about eating or yoking. It's not about any of that stuff, really. It's just meeting those things as best you can. When I was preparing for lecture, the idea of doing lecture, I was rummaging around in the Shobo Genzo, where else, and thinking Dogen must have something to say about practice period, and sure enough, there's a fascicle in there called practice period. And quite a bit of it is things like, on the 10th day, the abbot enters the hall, etc., etc. But there's this one little story that I liked, and Buddha has been in a 90-day summer practice period and is just about to end. And Manjushri waltzes in. And Mahakashapa says, "Where have you been for the 90-day practice period?" And Manjushri says, "In a demon's palace, in a rich man's house, and a house of prostitution." And I guess Mahakashapa's a little upset. He's ready to bring down the gavel and expel Manjushri from the assembly. And suddenly, 1,000 monasteries with 1,000 Manjushris appear, and Buddha says, "Which one of these Manjushris are you going to expel?" Now, I'm not going to continue necessarily with the rest of the story, because in typical Dogen fashion, he starts flipping it this way and flipping it that way, and you're left wondering, is Manjushri right and Mahakashapa wrong, or is it the other way around? Are they both right? Are they both wrong? What's going on here? But Dogen says, a little later on, says, "Know that Manjushri was not a non-participant of the practice period." And I thought about that, and I thought, that's pretty cool, you know? He can be in a demon's palace, and be in the practice period? I thought about that quite a bit, and it made me think that there's a dhyanga going on, and it's not telsahara, it's not this enclosed container. There's a lot of permeability here. People come and they go according to their work schedule and their relationships and their health and so on. So when you go out that door over there, the dhyanga doesn't stop. When you go out and you meet people and situations and things out there, try to use Manjushri's eye of wisdom and see what's really going on. That's maybe more important than coming here and attending to the forms, although the forms support that activity. So I think if you're doing that during the practice period, the ongo. If it happens like that, then maybe the ongo doesn't ever end. I don't know. Anyway, that's about all I have to say. I haven't even looked at my watch. Oh, that's about right. Final words, as the great Mahabali said, don't worry, be happy, do the best you can. Thank you. So, anybody want to grill me now? Yeah.
You said that you were looking for to find a way to love everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Zen practice helped with that?
Well, I think you have to define love, and everybody who asks is probably going to say something different. I mean, to some people, you know, it's getting laid. That's all it is. You know, that's not what I'm talking about, obviously. To me, love is, it's some feeling of intimacy or connection with other people, and it can be between a parent and child, or spouses, good friends, and one thing I do think that practice does help with is I think it helps you meet people a little more directly than you might be able to if you weren't practicing. And I think the more you can meet people, if you want to use that meeting people and becoming intimate with them, truly intimate, as the definition of love, then yes.
Everyone?
Well, that's really a challenge, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I used to think about that. It's like, how can I love that asshole who's like being mean to that little puppy? Or whatever it might be, you know what I mean? And there's a lot worse going on in the world, as we know. So it is really difficult. And I think, could be completely wrong about this, the more you can expand this love or intimacy, the more you can include people that you don't necessarily agree with, or even somebody you downright don't like, that somehow they can be included too. But it's a challenge. Yeah.
Would you equate this love then with our, you know, the Mahayana and our Bodhisattva precepts?
Say that again, please.
Would you equate then the love with like the Bodhisattva vow to save all beings in that way?
Well, I think once again, it kind of depends on the definition. I mean, I think a lot of people would say love and compassion are not synonymous. But if you want to stretch that definition of love, like I just said to Jonathan, so that it starts to include more and more people, and maybe even everything, then I think then it you could say it is the vow to liberate all beings, you know, and have compassion for them in their suffering.
Thank you.
So when you first encountered Isanji, you weren't accustomed to seeing a Zen person that obviously joyous?
There were a couple people around. I mean, my memory may be failing me, but I really only remember just a small handful of people that were, and nobody was quite like him. He was like bouncy, bouncing with joy. You know, that was his demeanor, though. I think even he was probably doing that before he came to Zen. So that may have been a natural just way of being for him. But there was quite a bit of uptightness around Zen Center. I think a lot of people were sort of kind of bound by the forms. I feel in his case, he let the forms free him.
That's
and
what I was going to ask.
Joy comes out of freedom, I think. So,
what else do you value about him as a teacher?
Probably the main thing is that I felt like he accepted me just as I was, warts and all. But that was, once again, that was his way. He basically accepted everybody, warts and all. It was not very usual to see him be upset with somebody. He was pretty accepting of an incredibly wide range of people, way too wide for Zen Center on occasion. No. So that, you know, that is a rare thing, I think, to meet someone that accepts you completely as you are. I mean, you know, sometimes I'm not a very likable person. Why would somebody like me, you know? But it goes beyond like, though. That was really probably the main thing. It sort of goes back a little bit to I wanted to be loved, you know, and I wanted to love somebody, and I sort of got that through him, which is maybe not the best relationship one could have with a teacher. I don't know. It worked for me for the time that he was my teacher. Yeah. I got what I needed at that point in time. So.
Thanks.
I recently read a memoir of a Zen student. He's about my age. He was going in the Rinzai tradition. He practiced at Mount Baldy. But he said that in the book that basically that's what he got from his teacher was that kind of love.
But like complete acceptance.
That's what it was boiling down to.
Yeah.
What, that was the big lesson that he felt that the teacher was imparting to him.
Yeah. It's probably, I would think, well, maybe I might be getting ready to misspeak myself. I was going to say, I think that might be pretty common, but I might be wrong with that. People's relationship with their teachers may not include that. I can't say. I mean, it. All I know is it worked for me, and obviously in this other fellow's case, it worked for him. So. Well,
I guess I don't have any terribly difficult questions or anything like that, but
save those for later.
No, sometimes I'm feeling grouchy or irritated or discouraged, and sometimes I go down into the garden and I think, what all these people, you know, who lived here, you know, say, or what, and what would Isan say, or Philip, these sort of people? And to me, the response that seems to come up is, you know, be joyful and bring joy to others. And so to me, that really resonated with what you said about, you know, how Isan greeted you in the hall. And I really appreciated the way, you know, your story is has all these different places where it doesn't seem like there's a, you know, the goal or the summit or, you know, that, but that there's always, you know, an engagement, as you said, with these turning points. And it's hard, I guess for me, I get caught up a lot of times in thinking that there's a specific trajectory, you know, like this is where you gotta go and what has to happen and how this is supposed to be. So it's encouraging for me to hear about your story with its very organic, you know, dimensions.
Well, any number of places is the way unfolds beneath your feet. Right, so you don't know what the next split second's going to be. I may have a stroke right here in front of you and keel over, you know? I mean, we really don't know what's going to be happening. So the way literally does unfold with every step we take. And so you don't know. You can make plans, you can say, I'm gonna go in that direction, or I'm gonna do this, and so on. And sort of try it on for size, you know, and see if it's a good fit, if it works, and if your way may unfold in that direction, or it may come to a dead end, and you gotta go off in another way, you know. Kind of late. Yeah, thank you all very much.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true.